Welcome to the Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene and beyond. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Tara Minton.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. I am your host, Rob Cope, and today we're joined by the incredible man that is Martin Hummel. Hello, Martin. How are you doing?
Very, very well. Thank you, Rob. I'm a legend in your mind, I guess.
And in actual reality, but yes, especially in my mind. Martin, you are the, what could I call you? The ringleader? I can't think. You're sort of the godfather of the Ubuntu music label. The CEO. Are you the CEO? Is that the right word?
I tend not to get hung up on titles. I founded the label. I founded it originally with Quentin Collins, who's, as you well know, a jazz trumpeter. Very, very good one indeed. And that got us up and running. And from there, Quentin pursued his career further, and I took it on and took it to where we are now.
When did you found the label?
Okay, a little bit of a backstory for you. Long, long story made short. I lived in the corporate world for 40 years. I lived on an airplane 65%+ of my time over that period, running multinational businesses in advertising, marketing, and communications. And I loved what I did. I also remained involved in music, which we'll get into at a slightly later stage here. But essentially, when it was time for me to get out of the corporate gig and decide what I really, really wanted to do in life, I wanted to find something where I could give back to others the way so many had given to me during my career. And music was my love, my passion, and remains as such. And I decided to go that route initially as an experiment. Tell you a little story. I took my dear wife, who's not a jazz aficionado by any stretch of the word, to Pizza Express on Dean Street to see Dave O'Higgins and a guy named Eric Alexander, great, great New York-based tenor sax player, so two tenors up front. And Eric had become a good friend over time. I love his playing, and he's really a character. And we went to the show. Andrew McCormack was depping on piano for Jason Ribello that evening. And I would always give Eric a little bit of my guidance or advice on stuff. Eric is tremendously talented, but he's a juvenile delinquent at the same time. he essentially struggles to kind of keep things moving and working properly. Examples. The subject was his website, which I was hounding him about that evening. The guy was touring pre-COVID 200-odd days a year. You'd go on to his tour tab on his website. There wasn't a single show listed. The guy has appeared on well in excess of 150 albums as either sideman or lead. And you go on to his music tab, and there's nothing to listen to or even find there. he was also giving Skype lessons as a tenor player to people all over the world. And what does he do? He lets his Skype account expire. So you kind of get the idea of what I'm talking about. And as the beers flowed over the evening, the discussion got more and more animated about things. So we left Pizza Express on Dean Street and went to the Late Late Show Hang at Ronnie Scott's, where Eric wanted to continue playing. And as it was his turn to get up and play, he turned to me. And he, with his Cheshire cat smile or grin, said, "You know what? If you're so effing smart, why don't you manage me or shut up?" So he got up to play. My wife blushed. And Andrew McCormack, who was sitting next to us, turned to me and went, "Gee, if you're not going to try to help Eric, why don't you help me?" And that's how this whole thing started. I connected in with Andrew about 7 years ago. It started on a very modest level. I think it's fair to say that I was managing him. I was managing his music interests. He was with Edition Records at the time. And as a result of that, Edition Records ultimately asked me to join Edition as chairman and significant shareholder, which I did. And it gave me an insight and an understanding for how that side of the business worked. And I just thought there was a different way to do it that might be more beneficial to musicians. And that's how it all started.
Beautiful. So at that point, you tell us then the link with Quentin. How does he come into this moment where you decide you're going to found your own label? And then off you go.
Yeah, Quentin is quite an entrepreneur of sorts, and he's always kicking around interesting ideas. The way the label essentially started was Andrew's life partner, Noemi Nuti, who is a vocalist and harpist, wanted to release a debut album. And as a favor to Andrew, I said I'd be more than happy to give her a hand if I could. And I went around, shopped around, looked at the various options available, looked at the commercial or financial gearings that the respective labels were offering. And I just became more and more and more disappointed with what was on offer. And I didn't think most of the options were in the interests of the artists. And I think the artists deserved more. So ultimately, I turned to Quentin as a mate, and said, there's got to be a better way to do this, and I think we ought to try it. So we did it as an experiment, and it was literally just that, an experiment, which thankfully worked. And from there, we began to build, if you will, a repertoire of sorts. You know, the thing that for me was kind of interesting was that Noemi was our first. From there was Quentin Collins and Brandon Allen, QCBA, which was a wonderful, wonderful album with Ross Stanley and Enzo Zerilli on drums. But the thing that put us on the map in a huge way was a guy named Jim Richardson. You ever hear that name?
Yeah.
He's Leo Richardson's father.
Bass
Jimbo.
Mm.
Jimbo is the ultimate character, if I could put it that way. And I was at a late, late hang at Ronnie Scott's one night hearing Leo play when he introduced me to his dad. And his dad basically said two things. I want two things to happen before I die. And I've been very lucky to be this old thus far. Number one, I want to see my son achieve what I know he's capable of as a professional musician. And he said, you're doing a great job in helping him. Thank you very much for that. And he said, number two, all my career as a bassist, I used to record anything and everything I could at shows. And in 1983, from late March to early April, six evenings at the Canteen in Covent Garden, Jim Richardson played with Chet Baker in a quartet. And Jim recorded it with Chet's permission. And he was sitting on six nights of some of the best performance material Chet had ever recorded in his career. The question or issue is, how are you going to get this out? What are you going to do? And Jim wanted the world to hear it. He said, I don't care if I make money or not. I want people to hear just how magical those evenings were. So he tasked me with trying to find a way to do it. Contacted the Chet Baker estate in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Their first reaction was, you have no right to this music. You must surrender the masters or we will take legal action against you. It was kind of like, yeah, nice to meet you too. And I talked them off the ledge after a significant period of time. And 6 months later, we agreed to work together to release this music. Second step of that was, if you will, trying to bring it back to its original glory and integrity because it was recorded very poorly. The tapes were 30 plus years old. The magnetic particles had dissipated. The tape itself had stretched. So it was a dog's dinner, if I could put it that way, but with a lot of good work from a lot of people. we made this sound the way it did, as if you were there in that room at that time. And when those two double live albums came out 2 years apart from each other, the world took notice of Little Ubuntu Music. And all of a sudden, we became, in the eyes of most, a legitimate label. And I no longer had to beg, borrow, and steal for people to return my phone calls because they were calling me.
That must have been a great moment to get that, especially talking them off, as you say, off the ledge. Like, that's something I suspect with many years of your career and the training you'd had was very important. It could have very easily gone so horribly, horribly wrong in that moment.
Exceedingly important, Rob. You're absolutely positively right. I mean, we learned how to sell snow to the Eskimos.
So then you've got a big album and lots of people know of Ubuntu. Then what happens? Because now there's been about 155 roughly releases. Is that right?
Yeah, this year we'll surpass 170 releases in about 7 years.
That's an immense body of work.
There's great, great music out there, Rob. I mean, fantastic music. And sadly, I can say this as a dual national, Yank and Brit here. You know, I think the Americans have always had the podium, so to speak, and the Brits, when it came to jazz, were secondary considerations, unfairly, I might add, but nevertheless, I think as a generalization, that's basically been true. I think over the last 5 to 10 years, the Brits are punching above their weight in a really big way, and more and more and more people around the world are taking notice. And I think the, you know, digital technology and specifically streaming has accelerated that considerably.
I agree. There's this weird sense of like, because there's a lot of Americans on UK labels, even, you know, that's like, there seems to be more of an opportunity for people to release their music here. Possibly, I don't know. It makes me wonder sometimes, what's going on over there then, you know?
Yeah, the landscape has changed. You know, the nature of the business itself has changed immeasurably. And I think for most, if your primary objective was to earn a healthy living, you wouldn't be going into the music business, or specifically the recorded music business, as I did. Because I don't do it for money. I do it for the love and the joy and the sheer satisfaction I derive in being a part of this wonderful, wonderful community.
I think, well, the thing is, from my experience, is that seems like a pretty good start for a working relationship in the world of jazz. If someone's out to make money, it's going to get really ugly really quickly, I suspect. And we both know of so many horror stories of people getting with the like wrong people or in the wrong label, or, you know, being given cash advances that you can't possibly hope to pay back with the money you're going to supposedly make from CD sales. I don't know.
Yeah, you're 100% right on that. And I think that is what has given the industry in general and record labels in particular the kind of reputation that hangs around the pond scum area, if you will, you know, promising the world, not wanting to disappoint. And also a lot of the guys in this business don't have commercial knowledge, understanding, or integrity. And as much as we don't like to talk about the business, the fact of the matter is it's basically a balance between art and commerce. And if it's all art and no commerce, you're going to go bankrupt. And if it's all commerce with no art, no one's going to buy or listen to your music. So there needs to be that healthy balance. And that's what I try to bring to the party.
Is there anything you look for specifically when artists approach you with their music? Do you, you know, what goes on in this, like, I don't know if you could call it a selection process, but from your perspective on the other side of the label, kind of releasing the music, what is it like?
That's an interesting question. And I wouldn't pretend there's a formula to it. I think what I bring to the party, unlike a number of others who do something similar to what I do, is, look, I was a failed guitarist, a failed saxophonist, a failed pianist, but dare I suggest a very good drummer. And I have a sense for performance, but I walked away from that at a fairly early age to pursue other interests. So I have a healthy respect and regard for that side. But if the truth be told, I'm a punter. I'm an enabler. I'm the guy who goes to shows and sits in the background where I hope people don't see me there. And I'm constantly listening to new and different music. And what do I look for? An element of uniqueness, a true and genuine voice that is the voice of the artist rather than simply replicated by others. I also look for the passion. I mean, you've got to have passion in the stuff you do. If you don't, people will smell it and they'll walk away from it. So having passion for your music, your project, and a commitment to do everything you can to make that successful is absolutely critical to me. And then it's also down to something that's been surfacing on Facebook recently, if you've been watching some of this stuff. You know, more and more venues are saying, we're not going to touch you unless you are actively promoting your shows. You need to put bums on seats. You need to bring people into these venues because we can't do it ourselves. And I'm a big, big proponent of that, because if musicians aren't promoting their own shows, how do you expect people to take their hard-earned money and go and come to see you? Very simple in my book. So it's kind of like a combination of those things.
Is there anything with the... with, like, you know, some labels have like a, they try and establish an identity or a certain sound. Yep. How do you feel about that?
No, it's a very good question. And it's horses for courses, if I might say so. I mean, for example, I grew up loving ECM as a label, Blue Note as a label, Verve as a label, Polydor. I could go on for some time, but, you know, ECM was the one that had firmly established its brand identity in a very, very strong manner. I think that was its inherent strength and at the same time, its potential vulnerability. When I started this label, I looked at the landscape and the business in a very different way, and I thank my advertising and marketing background in part for it. I wanted the label and its portfolio of musicians and their music to mirror the essence of jazz itself, which is a multi-dimensional music genre or art form. It's almost impossible to define other than the art of improvisation. And I, for my money, that was the inherent strength of jazz itself. So therefore, I wanted to have a portfolio of artists and their music that represented that broad landscape. So I didn't go the ECM route at all. I went the polar opposite.
Oh, well, I agree about everything, the ECM thing, and also about the fact that you've got such a, and it's such a strength for Ubuntu. There's such a diverse range of music, a diverse range of people, you know, and it looks like something that I think, let's take like younger students as an important example, that will look at that label and think like, there's a space for me in this industry. You know, there should be something there that they connect with or resonate with.
That's very interesting you say that, Rob, because, you know, I have a very strong affinity to helping young talent in any way I can. And I think they're the ones who need it the most. It is intimidating. You know, you go to music college and you're wrapped in cotton wool for 3 odd years, give or take. And then you get out into the real world and it can be a very sobering, if not brutal, experience. And you don't know who to trust. You don't know the good stuff from the bad stuff. And it's a minefield. And what I have done disproportionately is to work with young artists The ones I believe in, the ones who have that innate talent, and do whatever we can to help them achieve their potential.
The trust thing is so important, because when I was one of those kids once coming out of college, and, you know, I remember talking to colleagues. I think at this point, Pete Lee had already had his album.
That's right.
And Leo had Richardson and Camilla George. And you know, if I had said to them, like, oh, do you think they'd be interested? Do you know, is this even worth it? Can I trust this guy? And everyone would just be like, yeah, absolutely. You know, you like to earn people's genuine trust that they would recommend you behind your back seems like a really good compliment to me. But that's what it was for my experience with you, was like, I desperately wanted to be involved because I knew you were somebody that you could trust, which is actually really hard to find.
Yeah, it is, generally in life and specifically in the music business.
Yeah, it's just like, you just don't want, I don't know. Yeah, it's a very difficult experience to know what to do. And the fact that you've been such an incredible mentor for so many musicians is the value of it is very hard to quantify at this point. But what I would love to know, I mean, there's value in the sense that we could read down all of the artists that you've released and be like, these literally people you've helped massively. But there's so much more to it than that as well. Tell us what's going on. What's coming up for Ubuntu? What are some of the things that you're really excited about?
Yeah, we've got some very interesting stuff. A fair amount has yet to be announced, per se. But recently released a solo album of Tom Ohlendorf, who is an incredibly talented, gifted young guitarist. I've agreed to release Elaine Delmar's next album. She was
nice.
Yeah, she was voted Vocalist of the Year at the Parliamentary Jazz Awards this past year. I think she's on a trajectory. She acts as young as can be, given, you know, what her actual age might be.
I love that about her so much.
Yeah, she's just a wonderful, wonderful human being. Equally so, Art Thiemann, who's in his 80s, who has a fabulous live organ trio album, which we're going to release in November. I've got Aunt Law and Brigitte Behara coming out, which is going to be a lot of fun. I've got a bunch of U.S.-based hornsmen who used to play with Thad Jones, Joe Magnarelli, Dick Oates, and Gary Smoilian. Coming out also later this year. I've got Hungarian piano trio. I've got Israeli guitarist based in New York right now. I've got Trevor Myers, who's a horns player who just recorded at Rudy Van Gelder's studio in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. I've got an interesting female Israeli drummer who's New York based. Triple, Paul Booth, Ryan Quigley, and Trevor Myers coming out with their second album. There's a whole bunch of really, really interesting stuff happening. And of course, Tim Garland's album is about to come out. I mean, you just
he was the last. Yeah, he's the episode before this one. So actually, this is great for the
That's
listeners.
Right.
Ties in beautifully. Yeah, so Moment of Departure
Seamless.
Is coming.
Seamless. Yeah, no,
almost
Tim
as if
is.
I've planned it.
Tim is such an extraordinary, extraordinary talent, and just overflowing with ideas. It's never ending, and I have nothing but tremendous admiration and respect for him. You also spoke very recently with another one of our artists, Simon Lasky, his great album, and we're cross-pollinating as well, which is great because Tim Garland and Paul Booth, both on Ubuntu, collaborated with Simon on his latest release. So great stuff coming up. Ralph Clarkson as well. Equal Spirits,
yeah.
A joint venture of London meets South Africa in music, is a tremendous, tremendous project. And that's on its way out at the end of the month. So yeah, lots of really, really good stuff. And of course, it was your album. Don't forget your wonderful work, young man. Which we'll be getting into very soon, I believe.
Let's do it. I tell you what, Martin, thank you so much for coming. This has been a massive honor and a delight for me, and a show I've wanted to make for about 6 years. So I can only apologize it's taken so long. But we all thank you on behalf of me and everyone else who's gotten to work with you for all the work you've done. You're an incredible man. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. I don't deserve those words, but I'll take them anyway. And the thing that you need to just understand is it gives me so much joy. It gives me so much pleasure to be doing this and to be hopefully making a bit of a difference for others. You made an old man feel real good.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Martin. We will see you next week on the Jazz Podcast with Emily Massa.
There you go.